Welcome to Brightown Broadcast News for Monday, October 30th, 2023. Mike Adams here. Thank you for joining me. It's pretty easy to lose sight of the big picture and get lost in all the details of how many people are dead and how many buildings have been bombed and which countries have denounced which other countries and how many ships are being maneuvered into place and how many denouncements have been issued by official organizations. I want to remind you of some big picture things that are actually driving what you're seeing right now. And here they are. Do not forget these things. No matter what happens in Israel and Gaza, the Middle East, or Ukraine or Russia, do not forget these key things. That the globalists despise America. They need America destroyed. In order to achieve that destruction, they need, number one, they need to cancel elections. Can't have any elections, especially with Joe Biden being so incredibly ineffective and unpopular. Secondly, they need nationwide gun confiscation. They've got to take the arms away from the American people. This is why you're seeing so many mass shootings right now, by the way, MK Ultra operations. And then thirdly, they need a cover story for the financial collapse that even they cannot stop from coming. They know the financial collapse is near. They don't want to take the blame. They need a cover story. They need a world war. From these three things, the need to cancel elections, the need to confiscate guns, i.e. cancel the Second Amendment, and also the cover story for the financial collapse, from these three things, everything else is taking place. The buildup of war in the Middle East, the dispatching of two aircraft carrier groups or carrier strike groups, the unwillingness to support a ceasefire, the buildup of more weapons, more bombings, more attacks designed to provoke the Arab world into a reaction that would lead to World War III. The people running the world, the globalists, the WEFers, and so on, they know that this is exactly what is needed in order to completely gut the United States of America, to cancel elections, cancel the Bill of Rights, cancel the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, right? And do the final looting of taking everybody's money as the banking system collapses. So once you understand this point, everything else makes instant sense. If you're asking, for example, well, why doesn't the USA call for negotiations? Ceasefire on both sides. Like, everybody stop the bombing, stop the missiles. Let's exchange all the prisoners. Let's sit down and have diplomacy. Let's figure out how we can live together. Why isn't the US calling for that? They don't want that. They need this to escalate, and they need Iran involved. And have you noticed how the Wall Street Journal has been dutifully reporting whatever the CIA tells them to report, which is always how Hamas is linked to Iran, which is a pretty outrageous claim, given that it's actually Hezbollah that's linked to Iran, not Hamas. But, I guess they think the American readers don't know the difference. They both start with H, must be the same group. It's not. The truth is that the Wall Street Journal is being handed orders of what to publish. And for example, their original story right after October 7th that claimed that Hamas was trained under the direction of Iranian military leaders, that story didn't cite a single source. Think about it. No sources, no corroboration, nothing. They just made it up. They were handed a script. Here, print this. And since then, the Wall Street Journal has printed another story that says Iran is involved in all of this as well. Why? Why is that? Because the U.S. needs an excuse to attack Iran. And if you don't realize that, just listen to Lindsey Graham on any given day, or frankly, any of the politicians in Washington right now, certainly all the GOP. They just can't wait to attack Iran. In the back room, they're probably just singing and dancing, bomb, bomb Iran, bomb, bomb Iran, bomb, bomb Iran, bomb, bomb Iran. You know that song goes, bomb Iran. That's Lindsey Graham singing that. Dude's crazy. And how far is the West willing to go to achieve these big picture outcomes that I mentioned? Well, they're willing to go all the way. There's nothing they won't do. Even the new Speaker of the House, Johnson, I think is his name, has said, well, let's see, he was part of a gathering of pro-Israel donors, and he personally assured Netanyahu that Congress will back the war, quote, unwaveringly till the end, which means that doesn't matter what Israel does, that the U.S. Congress will back the war no matter what, no matter if there are real war crimes being committed, no matter if there's nuclear weapons deployed by Israel, no matter what. And Johnson says, quote, as a Christian, we believe the Bible teaches very clearly that we're to stand with Israel. And of course, the follow-up question is, no matter what? Because that's not what the Bible teaches. It's not no matter what. It's not anything goes. And as we've talked about before, Israel as a nation has, of course, rejected the teachings of the Bible long ago. Israel is, by and large, not a religious nation. It's a secular nation, much like the U.S., that has embraced abortion and vaccine damage and LGBT and, you know, transgenderism all over Tel Aviv, and now is making a lot of decisions that, you know, frankly, Jesus Christ would disagree with. You know, there's a word for people who believe the Bible excuses inhumane behavior. That word is zealot. That's right. That's the word, zealot. I mean, Christians are supposed to act in a pro-humanity fashion. They're supposed to act in accordance with the demands of God, which is essentially to protect life, not to murder people, kill people, commit ethnic cleansing, to kill women and children, to bomb hospitals and so on. Anybody who does that and says it's okay because the Bible told me so, they're a zealot. Not a real Christian. No, I mean, not a genuine Christian. Zealots. I mean, anybody can run around and just start murdering people and say, oh, the Bible told me to. And they can probably find some, you know, out of context little snippet here. He says, see, look, God did that to the Egyptians, so, you know, I can do this. And then they can just justify anything. That's misreading the Bible. The Spanish Minister of Human Rights has now called for all Western countries to cut ties with Israel. And, importantly, for Netanyahu to be put on trial for war crimes. Yeah, that's what's coming out of the government of Spain at this moment. Yeah, Spain. And then, of course, far, far worse condemnations from Turkey and Iran, obviously, and Syria and many other nations. The Saudis, at some point, will become even more harsh in their condemnation. But there's no one in the U.S. government that is even willing to denounce actual calls for genocide. And here's someone on Israeli television who is straight up calling for that. I'm going to read the transcript of this in English while the actual person on Israeli TV rants. So here we go. Do not leave a stone upon a stone in Gaza, he says. Gaza needs to turn to Dresden, yes. Complete incineration, he says. No more hope. We are still in the Oslo agreements and still knocking on the roof. This night, the Air Force still knocks on the roof. Before it bombed a lame tower in a hospital, he's saying that's not enough, around Al-Shifa Hospital, instead of flattening all of Gaza. So all of your 64 mandates, Benjamin Netanyahu, now need to protest in front of your home. He says, annihilate Gaza now. All right, so that's what a guest on a TV show is saying in Israel. Annihilate Gaza now. By the way, when he says knocking on the roof, that's a reference to a tactic that the Israeli military does where they bomb the roof of your building with a smaller explosive. I don't know if it's a 100-pound bomb or what. Bomb the roof, and that's called knocking on the roof, and it's your warning to leave the building because the next bomb is going to hit the foundation coming in usually from an angle and take out the structural integrity of the building and flatten the entire building. So knocking on the roof means you only have maybe a couple of minutes to leave or you will die in the rubble or be trapped alive, buried alive, perhaps with your family. And this guy on Israeli TV, he's angry that Israel is still knocking on the roof instead of just bombing everything, bombing all the buildings into rubble right away, like as if there should be no warning to anybody inside. I mean, that's seriously, this is what some people are arguing for. And then Trump just recently said over the weekend, he said that all the deaths in Gaza are the fault of Hamas, not Israel. So it's all Hamas's fault. So when Israel tells a hospital, you know, evacuate in 2 hours, and the hospital's like, what? We can't evacuate a whole hospital in 2 hours. And then Israel bombs the hospital and kills people. Israel says, well, that's not our fault. We warned them. And Trump says, yeah, they were warned. Those deaths are on Hamas, not Israel. So imagine if everybody in the world operated this way. You know, imagine if, you know, some psychopath in America, let's say, didn't like some neighborhood or something, right? And maybe he had a bunch of bombs, let's say. And then he ran around the neighborhood distributing leaflets that said, evacuate in 12 hours or you'll be bombed. And people are like, what is this? We're not leaving. And then he bombs them all and kills a bunch of innocent civilians. Then whose fault is that? Well, it's the fault of the bomber. But I guess Trump would say, no, it's the fault of the people who didn't leave. It's their fault. Or it's maybe it's Hamas's fault because they were warned. We told them to leave. We told them to leave their homes. We told them to get out of the hospitals. We told them to get out of the refugee camps, the aid camps. They didn't leave. They got bombed. It's on Hamas. Yeah, that's the kind of twisted logic that we're hearing right now. And that's just an example, by the way, of how far America is willing to go in order to achieve the big three things I mentioned right up front. They've got to cancel elections. They have to have a cover story for the financial collapse. And they need gun confiscation. Well, they can't do those three things if there's peace in the Middle East. They need a world war. And that's why they're sending so many ships. I mean, I'm looking at a graphic of all the ships, all the naval vessels. It's unbelievable. It seems like it's easily over 40, 50 ships that are, I mean, just in the Ford carrier strike group, there's six ships. And then you have the Eisenhower strike group. That's another at least five or six, plus there's usually a submarine goes along with that. Turkey has put out apparently something like 100 ships, naval vessels. And let's see. We've got other countries with all kinds of ships. I mean, I've never seen a map of so many ships in the Mediterranean Sea. And then the U.S. flew in over the weekend at least 50 transport cargo planes full of equipment and gear and soldiers, by the way, soldiers as well. The U.S. is gearing up for something absolutely huge. And it's clear. It's clear what they want. They want world war. Now, there was a really short post from a Twitter user called JD Sharp. I'm going to read it for you here. The Biden administration is now actively preparing for the Israel-Hamas conflict to expand across the Middle East, which means a terrorist attack will happen on U.S. soil shortly. Yep. And it will be used to declare martial law and cancel the 2024 elections. Exactly. It's exactly what this is going to be. That's why the border has been open for 3 years, and they're making life very hard for Americans without a care in the world. We wanted sleeper cells to form here, a religious war to start in the Middle East that we fully support, and the motivated sleeper... He's talking about the Biden administration supporting this. And the motivated sleeper cells to manufacture a mass casualty event on U.S. soil that the government would exploit. It's possible 2024 becomes the craziest year in history. In fact, yeah, this is exactly the plan. And, you know, I've had guests on, Michael Yon and others, talking about the invasion of the United States. And that invasion of illegals has a large number of, you know, Middle East terrorists, radical Islamic terrorists, who are ready and willing to target infrastructure across the United States when given the go signal. And when is that go signal going to be given? Well, probably not that far off here. It's going to happen. There's going to be a day in the Middle East when the Arab nations attack Israel. It's going to be Hezbollah. It's going to be Turkey. It's going to be Iran. It's going to be a combined effort. That's what's clear to me. Did you know that Russia has been meeting with the leaders of all these nations, and Russia even met with the leaders of Hamas? That Russia is also able to provide weapons to Iran, including nuclear hypersonic missiles, and that Pakistan is able to provide nuclear weapons to Turkey? Did you know that? So Israel's not the only gang in the neighborhood, so to speak, to have nuclear weapons. There's a lot of nukes from a lot of nations. There's a lot of hypersonic missiles. And all this convergence of naval vessels and armaments and armies all in one place? Come on. It's pretty obvious what's about to happen here. And when the go signal is given in the Middle East to attack Israel, at the same time, the go signal will be given in the United States to the terror cells who have been pre-positioned here. And that's a day when you you do not want to be in a football stadium. You know, you don't want to be in a train station. You don't want to be in an airport. Who knows what's going to happen? But I've warned over the years here in this podcast with all my special guests, my friends in the Texas, I don't know what I'm allowed to say, the Texas Special Forces, or I'm not sure what the proper term should be. Guys who fight for Texas on the border, you know, and I've been told by other former Army intelligence sources about who's coming across the border, what they're bringing across. You've heard me say this. We know that they have surface-to-air missiles. They have portable mortars. They have RPGs, of course. They have full auto weapons. They've got illegal suppressors and all kinds of things, and it's all staged. Oh, they have uniforms. They have police uniforms, National Guard uniforms, lots of uniforms staged in storage areas. And on the activation day, they will go to the storage areas, they will retrieve their gear, and they will begin to assault America from within. And that's desired by the administration, because the administration needs an excuse to declare martial law. And what a perfect opportunity to do so. Oh my gosh, we're under attack. We're under attack. Look, they're blowing up bridges. Look, they're blowing up electrical infrastructure. Oh, you're in the dark. Oh, too bad we couldn't see that coming. Oh, they blew up the ports. They blew up the refineries. You have no fuel. You have no comms. Better declare martial law. And then the government will say, oh, we have to round up weapons. You can't have citizens with weapons, you know, because it's so unpredictable right now. Have to disarm the citizens. You can see exactly where this is going. When, of course, armed citizens are the answer to this, by the way. And if anybody needs any justification for arming the citizenry, look at October 7th in Israel. I mean, it was the armed citizens, mostly, you know, IDF military or some veterans or reservists, who fought back and killed Hamas. So armed citizens are the only answer to this. You're going to need armed citizens to put down the terrorists when they get activated across America. Oh, don't forget your water supply can be easily targeted as well. So yeah, your food supply, water supply, electricity, communications, everything, police stations, ports. What have I left out? Yeah, I mean, you get the idea. They're going to go after everything. And most Americans are going to find themselves completely unprepared. Like, what happened? They're attacking us here? Yeah. What, you thought it was just going to happen in Gaza or in Israel, in the kibbutzes? No, this is happening in, you know, L.A. It's happening in Chicago. This is happening in New York City. Of course it's going to happen there. Again, the government will cheer it. I mean, publicly they'll say, oh my gosh, it's so horrible. But behind the scenes, they'll be like, yes, this is the crisis we needed. Never let a crisis go to waste. Let me read you another post from a guy, I don't know who this guy is, but his name is Keem, K-E-E-M. He had a pretty good post, so he's on Twitter. Most Americans are completely unaware how bad this Middle Eastern conflict is and how it will affect them directly. So let me try to explain it in the most basic way. Israel's response to the terrorist attacks is nonstop bombing. Thousands of Palestinians are dying. He's right. There's over 8,000 Palestinians dead so far. And about 4,000 of them are children, in case you're keeping track. He continues, the U.S. is threatening all neighboring countries to not get involved. Right. That's the presence of the aircraft carriers and so on to try to tell, you know, Lebanon and Syria and Iran, like, don't get involved. Otherwise, you know, we'll launch missiles at you. Those neighboring countries have all made public statements that Israel is committing war crimes and must be stopped. The Islamic world has never been more united. Countries with powerful militaries like Iran and Turkey may attack Israel at any moment. The United States simply does not have the manpower to protect Israel if these other countries get involved. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Our ammunition has been almost depleted by giving it all to Ukraine. That's true. Do not forget, in my interview with Jeffrey Prather, what he said. He said he has intel, I mean, direct intel from people in the National Guard that say that some National Guard bases in America are out of ammo and out of guns, like out of the hardware. When I say guns, I mean artillery pieces, for example. They're gone. They've got nothing, no ammo, no guns. Defenseless. All right, he continues. Ukraine has been flattened and has already lost the war, he says. For some reason, they're just not admitting it. Russia has already claimed and has all the territory in Ukraine that they wanted. Tons of our troops are stationed in places like Poland to stop Russia from moving east. I think he means west, which they would never do. Doesn't make sense for them to do that. The U.S. just banned civilian firearm exports. That's true. That happened, I think, late Friday. All firearm exports out of the United States are banned, except to Israel, by the way. Oh, and Ukraine. And Ukraine. Israel and Ukraine. All the guns you want. Everybody else, no guns for you. This is probably a strong sign that America is gearing up for war. This could be the very start of trying to reserve any resources we have for a major war effort. Israel, over the last couple of years, has been supporting Ukraine, which obviously would make Russia mad, and Russia has good relations with Iran. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to start seeing the teams forming around the world. So how would this affect Americans? Gas prices through the roof. Food prices through the roof. Inflation. A military draft. Yeah, we'll talk about that more in a minute. Sleeper cells. Terrorist attacks on U.S. soil are now way more likely, not to mention multiple countries that could bring the war to the U.S. mainland. Mm-hmm. Talking about the CCP with the Mexican narcos. Hmm. He continues, there must be a ceasefire in the Middle East now before it's all too late. But the Biden administration has shown time and time again they have no interest in de-escalation or peace. So we must demand the ceasefire ourselves. That's the end of his post. Now, the draft issue, this is a big issue. There's almost certainly going to be a draft in the United States. And that's because, of course, the military cannot currently meet its recruitment targets, not by a long shot. And the U.S. doesn't have a shadow of what it had in the Gulf War in the early 1990s. In order to wage a ground war in the Middle East, which is probably where the U.S. wants to take this, they're going to need a lot more bodies, a lot of young men, and maybe young women to feed into the meat grinder of the Arab-Israeli war. And so you're going to see, you're going to see mass uprising across America as the youth. I mean, this is going to resemble Vietnam, actually, in a lot of ways. America's youth and the college campuses and so on, they're gonna react and have a lot of protests that say no draft, no war, you know, calling for peace, which in this case, I agree with calling for peace, by the way. But guess who's going to get drafted? Young men and women, because we now live in a country that says there's no difference between men and women. So therefore, women will be drafted right alongside men. I mean, after all, if a man can say he's a woman and beat up women in mixed martial arts and Brazilian jiu-jitsu and boxing and wrestling and everything else, then I guess men and women according to the administration, they're all the same. So then women should be drafted too. I mean, why? How can you only base a draft on biology that the administration says isn't even real? So you'd have to draft women too. So can you imagine a nation of young, mostly liberal women being drafted into the military to go die in the Middle East, getting shot by Arabs? Like, that's actually about to happen. But at some point in all of this, perhaps soon, of course, the banking system collapses. And right on cue, the Biden administration will say, look, Russia did it. It's Russia. It's those Russian hackers. It's those Iranian hackers. They took down our entire banking system. And that's why your bank doesn't work. That's why your ATMs don't work. That's why you can't get any cash out. Oh, your account, it might be gone. Lucky for you, we, the government, we have a central bank digital currency system. And we will gladly replace your losses as long as you agree to the terms of service of the CBDC, which is, you know, we will monitor you and surveil you, and we can limit you of how you use your money, and we will automatically tax you, and we'll punish you if you tweet something mean, you know, all those kinds of things. And the average American, not wanting to starve to death, will say, okay, please, anything, just I need my money back. And they'll sign up. And that's how the CBDC gets launched, in case you were wondering. But for anybody holding gold and silver, by the way, that's going to be worth a fortune. I put out a tweet the other day and said, if the GOP would spend half as much time fighting for America as they do fighting for Israel, most of our problems would be solved by now. Have you noticed how the GOP in America, and also Governor DeSantis in Florida, by the way, they don't represent the American people. They represent Israel. I mean, it's Israel first. Look at the new speaker, Johnson. Israel first, America last. America never. No border for America. But anything that Israel needs, we got your back. We got your money. We got your weapons. We're going to send aircraft carriers in there. I mean, they never sent any military troops to defend our borders. We're being invaded. We have been invaded long before October 7th, by the way, for years. No one lifts a finger in America, and not the GOP either, by the way. GOP, pathetic. They don't deserve our support. And Ron DeSantis, you know, he's an authoritarian now. He says that if you speak out against Israel, you're going to be shut down. You might be criminalized. They had to shut down a student group there at the University of Florida because he says, well, they were a pro-Palestine group. That's not allowed in the state of Florida. So for those of you listening from Florida and you thought, you know, it's a good state with a good governor, you might want to check in with his policies, because if the governor disagrees with something that you might say one day, I mean, way beyond this issue, you could be criminalized or shut down or censored, because Governor DeSantis does not defend freedom, nor the freedom of speech. And notice that the GOP and DeSantis and others, even like conservative commentators like Ben Shapiro, who most people now believe actually gets orders from Mossad, by the way. But these people, they have no actual core values. They only have loyalty to Israel. That's it, no matter what it takes. And yet, Israel is really angering the entire world by blasting through lines that would normally be like, don't do this, you know, morality. But Israel's just blowing through them, just this with this incessant, endless bombing. And most of the world, most nations and most of the population of the world, including, I think, most Israelis and most Americans, do not support this. They do not support this ongoing war in the Middle East. And Scott Ritter, you know, former Marine intelligence officer, UN weapons inspector, following the Gulf War or during the Gulf War, he really described this well in a recent interview with Dialogue Works. And I want to play for you about 4 minutes of Scott Ritter explaining what's going on, why So many people and so many countries around the world are turning against Israel right now. And he summarizes this by saying, they've lost me. Israel's lost me. He used to be a big supporter of Israel, and now no longer. But listen to him explain it.
The Israelis right now are holding on to a wing and a prayer that they can get things back to where they were pre-October 7th. They think that they can defeat Hamas, but they know they can't. Hamas is an ideology, and the ideology of resistance is being magnified 100-fold with every bomb that's dropped on Gaza. Rather than defeating Hamas, Israel is expanding Hamas. Hamas has taken over in Turkey. It's in the United States in the streets. People are coming out in support of Hamas. People are starting to recognize Israel for what it is, because Israel no longer has the smooth-talking, well-educated con artists who would sell Israel as an extension of America, a democracy just like America, the same values as America. They're not even pretending that right now. They're putting forward generals and politicians who are saying things that if you eliminated the term Arab and Jew and replaced it with Jew and German, these speeches being given by Israeli is the same thing that Nazi Germans were saying in the 1930s and early 1940s, the exact same thing. And the world is seeing this. This is unfiltered. Israel is not like us. It is not a democracy that has as its principal reason for existence political Zionism, which allows Israel to behave as if they are the chosen few from God, exceptional people who have an inherent right to oppress those who get in the way of the creation of a greater Israel. I am an American, and in America, a fundamental principle is that all men, and now by extension, all women, are created equal. There is no supremacy attached to Christian, Muslim, or Jew, or atheist, or Buddhist, or any other religion out there. All people are human. All men are created equal. And yet Israel operates on the premise that Jews are superior, that Jews are the chosen ones, that Jews have a covenant with God to come to the Holy Land, and anything is allowed and tolerated if it fulfills that, to include the oppression of the goyim. And that is a term that is being used more and more in Israel today. Goyim, that means, it literally means an animal, a subhuman. The Israelis treat anybody who's not in favor of a Zionist state as animals. You know who else speaks like that? Stepan Bandera and his Ukrainian nationalists are the same thing about the exceptionalism of Ukrainian nationalism and the subhuman status attached to Russians, to Poles, to Jews. But we weren't allowed to say this because you couldn't speak out against Israel like this. Right now, we don't have to say anything because Israel's actions speak for themselves. The world is seeing the reality of what Israel is, and the world is standing up. As we speak, the General Assembly is coming together, and I hope they're going to act in the spirit of 1956, when the Security Council was frozen over the issue of the Suez Canal, and the General Assembly, with America's blessing, came forward and imposed its will on the international community, because the General Assembly has that power. And it is time for the General Assembly to take control of this situation and condemn Israel and punish Israel for the genocidal activities. You cannot have an Israeli ambassador in the United Nations criticizing the Secretary General of the United Nations for calling Israel out for what they are. If anybody's to be expelled from the United Nations, it is the Israeli ambassador and the nation of Israel. And if they're not careful, people like me who believe firmly that Israel has a right to exist and that Israel must be defended regardless of the criminal policies, you're going to lose me, Israel. And when you lose me, it's over for you. Because when I flip to the other side, everybody else is going to flip. Because I used to be a very close friend of Israel. I used to stand with Israel. I used to be on their side. And they have...
So there you go. There's Scott Ritter's explanation that, frankly, a lot of people agree with. And remember, again, Ritter was pro-Israel for most of his professional career. And now, Ritter said something else, by the way, in that interview. It's a really good interview with DialogWorks that I think is worth pointing out. Now, understand that Scott Ritter, as part of his military training and experience,
He used to run simulations of NATO battles. And those simulations would look at, you know, assets, soldiers and tanks and aircraft and naval assets and so on, and it would try to determine what strategies would work best to defeat, you know, Russia, for example, or any enemies of NATO. And in that experience, he gained a lot of insight into what makes armies succeed or fail, or where are their vulnerabilities in standing armies. And so he is highly qualified to speak on this subject. And in the next segment I'm going to play for you, he says that Israel is not ready for war with Hamas. Not ready, and they're going to take heavy, heavy losses. But to understand why, I mean, I've explained some of this. It's a cultural thing, right? It's the Israeli culture, just like the American culture, is among the youth mostly a culture of narcissism, complacency, or apathy. They're not tough people anymore, for the most part. Most of the youth of Israel and the United States are not, they're not tough people. They're snowflakes. They're hyper-privileged. Life's been too easy for them. They've never suffered a difficult moment, except maybe when the battery, when the phone didn't work. The battery went down, they lost their phone or something. That's probably the biggest crisis they've ever faced. And so they're not ready in Israel, all these reservists, 300,000 reservists, they're terrified. And they're not ready for real war, not with Hamas, not with Hezbollah, certainly. Hezbollah are mostly war veterans who fought in Syria, by the way. And they're not ready, the Israeli reservists, they're not ready for war with Iran or anybody. They're not, they're just not built for war. And yet they've been told that they're this kind of master race, this superior race chosen by God. They're the chosen ones that the Bible says they're going to win, and it's all been preordained. And the truth is, they're not a master race. They're not superior to all other human beings on earth. But listen to Scott Ritter explain that and why they're about to be slaughtered in this war with Hamas.
And what happens when you go up against an entity like Hamas? Hamas doesn't view the Israelis as superior because Hamas has successfully operated against the Israelis. They know the Israelis when they're at their best, and they know them at their worst. And Hamas built a plan that dealt with the reality of Israel. And the reality of Israel is they're not very good. October 7th proved that, proved it in spades. Their intelligence service just isn't that good because the Jews are not a supreme race. They are not imbued with some sort of special Jewish power. They don't wake up in the morning, drink Jewish coffee, and become supermen. They're humans just like us, the same as us. They get tired. They take shortcuts. They make mistakes. And if they buy into the notion of Jewish racial or ethnic supremacy, then they are not going to be aware of the mistakes they're making because they believe that they're above it. The Israelis became complacent. Look at their military. You know, the first thing I learned in the Marine Corps is that in order to win, you have to, you know, be willing to wade in and kill people, physically kill them, terminate them. We practice with the bayonet. Nobody else practices with the bayonet anymore. We do. Why? Because it's about killing. It's about plunging steel into a body, twisting it, pulling out, butt stroking, and going on. The physical act of terminating a life. The Israelis don't do that. Why? Because as I'm plunging a bayonet, the other person could be plunging a bayonet too. And I could take one in the chest. I could die. I have to be prepared for that reality. Israelis do not want to die. They are casualty averse. When they lose an Israeli soldier, that is a strategic defeat for the nation. They mourn. So they have built a way of war that avoids closing with and destroying the enemy through firepower maneuver. They have allowed technology to take over. They have allowed an over-reliance on aircraft, on missiles, on standoff weapons. The entire wall around Gaza, it was a wall designed to keep Hamas in, to prevent them from coming through tunnels. The wall was built to detect tunnels coming under. That's the Israeli mindset. Remote control cannons operated from a control booth where some 18 to 19-year-old girl sat there and drank tea and ate a donut and manipulated a computer, playing a computer game, because that's what it was to her. An image on a screen, a cursor, and shooting rounds. Bam, 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 bam. But what happened? Boom, when the drone took it out. Now what are you going to do, honey? Now what are you going to do? Because you can't see anything. So you're sitting there sipping your coffee, eating your donut. Hamas is closing in. They're taking out your sensors because they've planned it. They're not lazy. They know what they need to do. They come in, they knock on the door, take it down, and now you're dead because you didn't prepare for it. You're not standing up. You haven't fixed bayonets. You're not charging the door. You're not ready to die. You're scared. You're cowering. That's what happened to the vast majority of the Israeli forces on October 7th. They were scared. They were cowering. And if they go into Gaza, it's going to be 100,000 scared, cowering boys and girls who aren't ready for this fight because Israel isn't that good. And we need to make sure that everybody in the world knows this.
And you notice that the main attack on Gaza has apparently still not happened, at least not that we are aware of. It hasn't been one giant ground assault. It's been these nightly incursions where Israeli forces go in at night because they have an advantage in night optics, night vision equipment, and so on. And then they have bulldozers and they have tanks, and then they clear out in the morning before sunlight. Maybe this is what they're going to do for a while. Maybe they won't do the main attack, but there are fears that the main attack is, of course, still coming. But I'm wondering if Israel's military leaders are starting to have second thoughts about whether their soldiers are even capable of this fight. Seriously. Even with 300,000, I mean, I guess at some point they could just, you know, have meat attacks, just send them all in there, but they're going to take such huge losses. The question is, what will the Israeli people think? The voters. I mean, look at Netanyahu, his whole political future is at stake. And believe me, that's a factor in his decision-making. But let me read you some updates that are important from Al Jazeera, which of course is funded by the government of Qatar, in case you're wondering. They are reporting that the International Criminal Court, the ICC, one of its top prosecutors said that impeding relief supplies to Gaza may constitute a crime. Also, more children have been killed in Gaza in the last 3 weeks than the total number of children killed in conflicts around the entire world in any year since 2019. That was announced by a group called Save the Children. I mean, we're talking thousands of children now killed in Gaza. 33 aid trucks have entered Gaza on Sunday. That means a total of 117 trucks have gone through since October 7th. And it used to be over 100 trucks a day of just regular supplies. So, you know, these 117 trucks over a period of several weeks, this is not anywhere close to what the civilians need there. Reporters Without Borders, RSF as they're known, they've investigated the killing of a Reuters journalist in southern Lebanon on October 13th. And it says that six other journalists were wounded and that Reuters journalist was killed when munitions hit the village of Alma al-Sha'ab in quick succession. So those are believed to be Israeli munitions, of course, and what this report is saying is that Israel's military is specifically targeting journalists to be killed. Kenneth Roth, former executive director of Human Rights Watch, has warned that Israel could be charged with a war crime if it bombs Gaza's Al-Quds Hospital. Roth said, quote, "When you have 14,000 people in the hospital, many in critical situations where they can't be moved, an evacuation order doesn't suffice. It is wrong to suggest that whatever military advantage coming from hitting the supposed Hamas facility underneath would justify the disproportionate harm to civilians," he said. "Under humanitarian law, war crimes by one side do not justify war crimes by the other. Each side has an independent obligation to respect the laws of war." So, there you go. Now, keep in mind through all of this that none of our representatives in Washington, D.C. are going to do a damn thing to stop the gun confiscation, the canceling of elections, and the financial collapse that's coming. They're not going to do a thing. And if anybody out there is thinking the GOP is going to do anything, obviously they're not. They don't give a crap about America, and they're not going to lift a finger to protect our rights and freedoms, or even election integrity, our financial system, nothing. If you want to be protected against anything, it's up to you. You want to have your assets protected, it's up to you to get out of the dollar and out of the banks. If you want to have your safety protected, it's up to you to carry concealed where legal. If you want to actually have elections still running in your local area, it's up to you to get out there and be part of the election integrity effort so that we still have something resembling a constitutional republic, even when the Biden regime tries to take us to world war, which is exactly what they're doing. Also, by the way, it's very clear Breitbart.com doesn't represent America either. Breitbart represents Israel. And you've seen this among a number of publications and individuals. Oh, by the way, a false flag against U.S. naval forces is the most likely way to draw the United States into this war. So, you know, we got to say a prayer for all those men and women in the Navy, on the ships right now, in the East Mediterranean. You know that one of them is going to be probably sacrificed in a false flag operation to blame Iran. I mean, it's so abundantly obvious. You can easily see that's what they have in mind. And they'll just, you know, nuke a whole ship or something and say, Iran did it. Probably Iran did it using Russian missiles, and then it's on. It's like, oh, now we're at war. Now here's the draft. Now here's martial law. Now we have to have restrictions on your banking. Because we're at war, of course, and we have to have restrictions on the Second Amendment and restrictions on your free speech. You know, the government will control which websites are allowed to exist and which ones are not. And the only ones that can exist will have to be pro-Israel websites, by the way. That's obviously going to be the case at this point. I mean, it's so evident. So you want to know the best way to thwart these globalist plans? The best way is to join me in calling for peace. Seriously, it's the best way. If we have enough public pressure to say no more war, call for peace, ceasefire, diplomacy, prisoner exchange, then they don't have the public support that they need to just keep charging headfirst into this massive expansion of global warfare, from which they will eventually cancel our elections, confiscate our guns, or attempt to, and also run a financial collapse scenario to be blamed on, of course, America's enemies. So call for peace. Otherwise, we get tyranny domestically in the United States, and also, of course, domestic terrorism. There are groups that want to set off bombs all across America, and they have crossed the border, and they do have weapons. And again, the administration can't wait for those people to start popping off bombs, suicide vests all over the place. Because again, that puts more power in the hands of the administration, especially if they can blame, you know, their political enemies. Somehow it's going to be Trump's fault, clearly. Somehow. I'm not sure how they'll pull that off, but they will try it. In the meantime, of course, mass famine is part of the global plan. Engineered famine, a Holodomor on a global scale, which was one of the episodes that I talked about last week. And our special guest today for the interview is Professor Valentina Zarkova, who is an expert in the grand solar minimum and solar activity and its effect on planet Earth. You're going to like this interview. And it's also a warning to get yourself ready in terms of food preparedness, seeds and garden supplies, growing food, all of that. Because, of course, global famine goes along with all of this. They will use food as a weapon against all of us, just as Israel is using food as a weapon against Gaza by restricting food, essentially using famine as a weapon. That's exactly what's going to happen to the entire world. Remember, what they've done to Gaza is a pilot program for what the globalists plan to do to all of us, regardless of our religion or ethnicity. It's a pilot program. It's a human experiment. And they've already mastered a lot of the key technologies of surveillance and oppression and starvation, 15-minute cities and all that. So that's coming for all of us. And there's also a pretty good chance this whole thing goes nuclear at some point as well. Probably, like I said before, starting with Israel launching nuclear artillery rounds as the enemies gather from places like Iran, Iraq, Syria, Turkey, and of course, southern Lebanon with Hezbollah. So get ready. It's all coming down. You can see it every single day. And the number of days we have remaining where things are still functional is very limited. This is not going to be an easy time for any of us. And it's pretty clear that the powers that be are trying to make it as difficult as possible. So real quick here, a word about Health Ranger's store and some of the solutions we have for you, including a new iodine product. And then the interview with Professor Valentina Zarkova. Enjoy that full interview, and I'll be back with you tomorrow. Until then, God bless you all. Take care. Thank you for all your support of our platforms and healthrangerstore.com. And we have a new certified organic product that is very practical and important right now, given world events. It is a certified organic version of our nascent iodine. And here it is, Nascent Atomic Iodine, our Groovy Bee brand. And it's made with certified organic glycerin. So, of course, iodine itself, being an element, can't be organic or inorganic. I mean, the organic certification doesn't make sense when talking about just an element, just iodine. But the glycerin, which is the bulk of what's in this product, and it makes it very delicious to taste, by the way. It's, you know, iodine can be pretty harsh when it's in alcohol, and iodine itself can taste, you know, pretty wild. In this glycerin format at the right concentration, and it's organic glycerin, it's very easy to take. People love this formulation, and it's also easy for children to take, and even where appropriate for animals to, you can mix it in with their food very easily in this way. No alcohol, and the glycerin is all organic. So this is the Nascent Atomic Iodine formulation, available now at healthrangerstore.com. Here's the three-pack. We've got it available in different quantities. And believe me, as things start to really pop off in the Middle East, everybody's going to want to have the additional protection of iodine for, you know, thyroid support, among other purposes. And I use iodine for a number of applications, including I use it topically, but I use the alcohol version for topical applications. This with the glycerin is best for oral ingestion. Just use it as directed. Iodine is a heavy element, which means you can overdose on it. So don't go chugging bottles of iodine. That would be crazy. It's always a good idea to check with your naturopathic practitioner of how much iodine is appropriate for you. Maybe they can check your levels and determine how much that you need on an ongoing basis. It's not much. It's, you know, micrograms per day, technically, is all that a human being needs in terms of iodine. But if you're not getting it from other sources, i.e., if you're not eating a lot of seaweed, then you're probably not getting much iodine in your diet like Japanese do, because they eat so much seaweed, they get a lot of natural iodine. But for most of us, we don't get much. Even the iodized salt is only given enough iodine to just barely prevent obvious diseases caused by iodine deficiency. So iodine supplementation can be very, very beneficial. And this is the first form we've ever had available that is the Nascent Atomic Iodine in a certified organic, USDA organic format. And it's also lab tested in our laboratory to make sure it doesn't contain the heavy metals, glyphosate, microbiology. I don't even see how microbes could live in this substance, by the way. But we do all the testing, so we have all the internal lab certifications for safety in addition to all the label claims and the organic certification as well. So check it out at healthrangerstore.com. Get yourself prepared. This will be a really powerful barter item as well, depending on what takes place next in the Middle East or elsewhere, maybe involving Russia, who knows. This will be a very valuable barter item to have, probably better than cash, at least for anybody who knows the value of iodine. And we will be completely blown out of this when events start to happen. We don't price gouge, so we're not going to like make the price 10 times higher as some operators do. Instead, We'll just sell everything at the same current price, but it'll be sold out very, very quickly. And it'll be a long time before we'll be able to get additional iodine, you know, once world events take place. We may never get iodine, depending on what happens. We'll see. We'll do our best to bring it to you. But thank you for your support. Again, healthrangerstore.com. Welcome to today's interview on Brighteon.com. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon, and today we are joined by Professor Valentina Zarkova from Northumbria University, and she's also a professor of mathematics there, and her website talks about the grand solar minimum, which refers to, of course, a supercycle of solar activity that affects all of us here on planet Earth, including the, quote, climate. So this is going to be a fascinating discussion. Her website is solargsm.com, which stands for Grand Solar Minimum. Welcome to the show, Professor. It's an honor to have you on today.
Yes, a big pleasure to be with you.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to join us, and I was really impressed by an interview I saw you conducting with another media outlet. And I was intrigued by the fact that you were speaking so eloquently and rationally about the impact that the sun has on us here on Earth and the entire solar system. Could you start out by telling us a little bit about what you do and your website, Solar GSM, and why are you intrigued by this topic?
Well, I am a mathematician, and mainly I was doing plasma physics and this solar plasma physics. And I wrote a couple of books, about 200 papers and so on. But doing solar activity, we started in 2002 when my team got the European grant, European Grid of Solar Observation. So we got funding to investigate sunspot active regions and produce solar feature catalogs, which we produced by 2005. So we had a big database. And on top of all the plasma physics and applied mathematics, suddenly I got this nice statistical row, which I wanted to explore. So when grant was finished, we wanted to obtain some interesting result. We actually planned to automate producing the average sunspot numbers, which now done by observers from different observatory. And then we discovered, so we cannot do this because they put not very precise algorithm how they do this average sunspot number. It depends on each observer, and they put some coefficients, which is very difficult to calculate when you do this programming in your computer. So this is what we discovered, that we need to do something else. So this is how I got hooked in 2002, 2006, looking at the statistical analysis. At that time, I was teaching statistics at the university, so it was good coincidence.
Oh, yeah.
It was nice to know what you're doing. And so we started slowly doing a statistic. We discovered that probably better look not at the sunspots, but at the whole magnetic field, because we have a luxury. The magnetic field of the sun was observed from 1976 until now, and the full disk observations and the data are very good. And so this is how basically we started doing the research. And it was, I think, 2008, 2009 and 10, when we done exploration of our database with any others we have, and suddenly we discovered that sunspots actually appear not where they want. They actually modulated where they appear and when they appear by the background magnetic field. This one, which I started investigating because I thought the data very good, because it has 1024 pixels. So you have very good quality of the data. But it turned out this magnetic field defines where the sunspot appear and how they migrate on the surface. We published paper in 2008.
Okay.
We discovered. And this is how I started doing the solar activity, which is not plasma physics, it is interesting, like everyone now doing solar activity. So this is what I came from, different side, from scientific side, I started doing solar activity.
So how profound, I mean, in terms of your findings, what you've seen so far, How profound is the sun's impact on weather and climate and crop yields, for example, on our planet? Because personally, I find it astonishing that our press, our governments, our people, they focus on just what's on Earth and they don't look at the primary driver of energy cycles, which is, of course, the sun, and they ignore the sun somehow, which seems bizarre to me. What's your take?
It's absolutely bizarre, I have to say, because everything is designed and defined by the sun on Earth and other planets. And at the peak of the Kyoto Agreement, I was given a talk in Yorkshire to different companies. I discovered that Hoyt and Shatten and others, they showed that the other planets have similar global warming like we have. The ice on Mars was melting, similar when ice on the Earth was melting.
Yes.
And Jupiter had typhoon, which never had before. So basically, it proves that we cannot affect neither Mars or Jupiter. It has to be sun which affects.
Well, but, I ask this satirically, but are you sure it couldn't be the coal-fired power plants on Mars that are causing
yeah,
that?
Someone built and it's this red spot, which is there, it might be a coal-fired plant.
You never know. Anyway, you never know.
In 2010, I was discovered. And then we started working, started applying high mathematics. We used, we decided how we can extract what sun gives. Normally, at that time, I was teaching my students, students of astrophysics and physics, the course which called Waves on the Sun. And with these waves, I teach them that each system has own oscillations. They call natural frequency.
Yes.
And suddenly struck to me, why nobody calculated this natural frequency for the sun?
We have yes.
this huge amount of data for three solar cycles by that time, 2010, and no one calculated. So I thought, okay, I put my team, we got together, said, guys, let's do principal component analysis because this is the only mathematical tool which gives you precise. I have to say that calculation with principal component, it is not artificial intelligence. This is the precise calculation.
Yes.
Calculate eigenvector, eigenvalues, and then this eigenvector give you waves split like if you put white light on the triangle glass. A pyramid, you know that you put
a prism, yeah.
Yeah, prism. You put from the left white light, and from the right you get spectrum rainbow.
Yes.
You get from red to UV indigo. So the same effect on the magnetic field does principal component analysis. So I managed to split this very complex magnetic field for the whole sun, I split in separate components. So I've got two highest components which we used. And what we discovered that basically these components come in pairs. So you have two highest with the variance 39% and 38%, and then another two with the variance about 18%, and then another two and another two. So it sun tells me that these waves come in pairs, which came a complete surprise. I never seen the principal component gives you pairs, but voila, it gives you pairs. So this is why we added these pairs, the first pair, and we applied a dynamo model for this pair. We thought, okay, we got clear wave. It is natural oscillation of the sun. And because sun has north and south pole, obviously, we can apply normal dynamo model, don't we? Because this is what they do on the sun, dynamo formed by these dipole magnetic sources. As soon as we apply dynamo model from these two eigenvectors and join them together, suddenly, dynamo model started describing these magnetic eigenvectors very nicely, very beautifully.
Okay,
they shape like one to another, like this.
Well, a couple of questions, and let me help, I think, maybe help translate some of that for our audience. I mean, it sounds like You're using mathematics to deconvolute oscillation data in order to identify multiple frequency patterns.
Yes.
That normally when they're all together, it looks like chaos, but when you deconvolute them, you can identify the separate oscillations.
Yeah. I had this PRISM, principal component analysis. So I didn't do much. All the tool of PCA did, PCA principal component analysis. So
okay. All right. So then with these data that you have now extracted, I take it then you've been able to identify key periods of oscillation cycles.
Yes.
With which have predictive value, correct?
Yes. What we managed to identify now, because my two eigenvectors with the highest eigenvalue actually now correspond to the model developed by people in Solar Dynamo. It started fitting very well, this model.
Okay.
All other magnetic field does not fit, but this, because we clean it up from any other influences. So it started fitting very well. And we discovered that these two waves, which are traveling on the sun, they have close but not equal frequencies.
Okay.
So one has like 10.5 years and another has 10.9 or 11.2 years.
Interesting.
So, yeah, so this is not frequency period. Or frequency, it will be 1 divided by
right.
period. So what we discovered, these waves, like one way runs away from another wave.
Yes.
And so, interesting. So first of all, when these waves started fitting very nicely dynamo model, in our paper in Nature 2015, we produce correspondence of observed eigenvectors and simulated. And first time we could produce simulated dynamo model for 2,000 years. At the moment,
wow.
dynamo model cannot produce even one cycle ahead because they use the whole magnetic field.
I see.
Which is polluted.
Well, I see.
With our clean-up wave, which is on oscillation of the sun, we could produce the similar waves for 2,000 years. So as soon as we managed to produce them in Solar Dynamo, we thought, maybe this wave, if we put them into specific artificial intelligence package, but that time it was available, called Eureka, done by Schmidt and Lipton, it can identify analytical expression for this formula, which runs as eigenvector.
Okay.
Right? So we put it, and we got formula with about series about 5-6 cosine functions,
uh-huh.
which are published in our paper in 2015. So we got this formula, which get accuracy to the one we derived from PCA, about 97%.
So with these formulas, then we can calculate the current solar activity and also where it's going.
Yes, and we calculate for 1,000, and we calculate it for 120,000 years. As long as you can run your computer, put if you like your computer run for I say week or month, you can calculate million years.
Right.
Only problem, you need to keep your array, your series somewhere, so you need to split it because capacity of computers, they cannot keep large amount of arrays. So, but theoretically,
so,
yes.
Let me jump in then, because so if you're saying that one of the periods of the solar magnetic activity is 10 point something years and another
it's
period.
Approximately, if you can read that paper in Nature, we give comparison, how to get period 10.7 years, which we have now.
Okay.
So we give some options.
All right, and then there's another cycle happening that's a little bit longer, 11-something years.
Then, yeah, it's a normal cycle, 11 years.
Okay, so then, obviously, I mean, I'm just estimating, but somewhere between 90 and 100 years, these two cycles are going to peak together and have, you know, a lot of solar activity, and then somewhere else in that whole long cycle, they're going to trough together.
You probably haven't seen my pictures. But the 11th cycle runs every 11 years. So 11 cycle years, 11. But to get this 11th cycle, we have two waves. So one wave runs another. Both have nearly 11 cycles. But because they have different amplitude and different phase, after about 350 years, these two waves turn out to be in antiphase. So one wave has maximum, another has minimum, and this is we have grand solar minimum. So one wave runs away from another, but both of them are close to 11 years.
Okay.
And the resulting summary curve is about 10.7 years, which we measure right now.
Oh, I see. So this describes then you're going to have periods of climate stability, and then you're going to have other periods of climate chaos, in essence.
It is not chaos. It's called destructive interference.
So
they can have constructive interference. So if my two waves have phase, they both come in maximum, the amplitude of this cycle will be double because the both amplitudes are added. It's called constructive interference of wave. And then when you have another period, when one wave runs from another, then one wave is in maximum and another wave is in minimum. This is called destructive interference.
Right.
So the summation of amplitude gives you nearly zero. And this is what we are having in grand solar minimum, especially in cycle 26.
Okay.
You subtract this amplitude and this is resulting amplitude becomes small.
So that was my next question is sort of where are we right now on planet Earth in these cycles that you described? But you just said that the minimum is reached in 2026. Is that what you just said?
No, it minimum was grand solar minimum started already in 2020. It started slowly moving, but at the moment the maximum minimum will be in cycle 26, which will be 2031 to 2043, something like that. During that, so the all grand solar minimum will start showing after sun passes maximum of cycle 25, in which it is now.
Okay.
So we need another 2 years, maybe three, to sun passes cycle 25 maximum and start going to the descendant phase. In the descendant phase, this is where everything will start happening.
All right. So you're saying then cycle 26, and I'm not sure where that number comes from.
We cycle now 25, so we are at maximum. It will be finished by another 6-7 years. So it's 2023 plus 7, 2030, 2031. So by that time, cycle 25 will be finished. But when it goes to descending phase, it will be after 3 years. From 2026, it start declining. Solar activity start declining. And this is when solar activity declining, we get less radiation. We got less particles, not only to Earth, but to all other planets. And so we have less heating.
Okay.
And this is when we start feeling this grand solar minimum.
So, yeah, I want to ask you about the effects on Earth. Of course, cooling, crop yields will be impacted, obviously, ocean, thermal effects. But how long does this then minimum last? Is it... maybe we should just be looking at your charts, but beginning in early 2030s.
Mind you, the previous grand solar minimum was Maunder minimum, which was 17th century. Probably you read a lot what happened. They had six cycles when the solar activity was depressed. So we know that all rivers, including Danube, Thames, are frozen. They had ice.
Yes.
They had ice going to the... to the villages and from the mountains, so it was very cold. People felt very cold. So because it was six cycles, it was absolute minimum, much bigger than this one. The current one, grand solar minimum, will last only three solar cycles. It is cycle 25, which is now. Then after 2031 to 2042, it will be cycle 26. And the next cycle is 27, from 42 until 53. So this is when, and after 53, sun returns back to normal. This wave started running with constructive interference, and the solar activity will be again the same for another 300 40 years.
Now then, historically, whenever something similar to this has happened, we've seen the fall of civilizations, correct?
Well, yes, and the Europeans managed to survive during Mount the Minimum, but previous it could be very cold. They're not ice period. They're not completely ice like that when the dinosaurs died.
Right.
It will be much softer. The temperature decrease is about 1 Celsius. So it is not that dramatic. To get this ice period cold, it happens in 100,000 years. It's called Milankovitch cycle, and it is defined by the orbit and inclination of the Earth towards the Sun. So everything defined how Earth moves around the Sun and how nicely it inclined towards the Sun or outside the Sun. If Earth would be standing vertically, it will be a different story. So we are very lucky that we have some inclination. And at the moment, we have 22.4 degrees inclination. And this is why we have the seasons in yes. both hemispheres.
Yes, absolutely.
It's not ice age. It is grand solar minimum. It's only 1 degree drop.
But okay.
It drop.
But when you say 1 degree, first of all, that's a Celsius degree, which is, of course, much larger than a Fahrenheit degree. And then secondly, that's the global average temperature dropping by 1 degree, which is a very substantial drop.
Absolutely.
And the implications on crop yields, especially in countries that have marginal food production, where the growing seasons are already very short, this will cause those growing seasons to be substantially shortened, correct?
Yes, but even the countries who have very long production for crops, like Spain and southern country, they will be affected by the cold. Remember, we had, I think a couple of years ago, we had snow in April in Spain when all the greeneries were frozen out. Or we had snow in Morocco last year when we had supplies of all our salads and everything. We didn't have this supply for a month until they found another one. So this is when what was happening during the Grand Solar Minimum, the reduction of UV radiation from the sun because of reduction of solar activity because of this Grand Solar Minimum will cause a reduction of ozone in the Earth's atmosphere. This reduction causes these northern jets from Arctic. And we seen this northern jet last year when it was huge frost in Canada and North America. Or in Russia, they had minus 50, frost minus 50, minus 60, which they never had before last year. They will be increasing more and more. And this is because sun does not send us enough radiation, which we used to have. And this is why the north makes excursions toward the lower latitude. And the further it develops, the deeper to the lower latitude this excursion jets will be. So they will catch Spain as well. This is why, I don't know if you're aware, but very entrepreneurial Chinese businessmen, they're buying the land in Africa because possibly the only African land will be able to produce all the greeneries and all the food which is required when the worst of the Grand Solar Minimum will come.
This is really alarming what you're saying because, of course, many of the crops that are grown in Spain, let's say, or coastal regions of France and so on, they cannot handle a deep freeze, right?
Exactly.
And so all it takes is one cold jet from the north to come in and freeze out crops and orchards that can take a decade to restore, right? I mean, even in the United States, in Florida, you know, we have citrus orchards, and in California, we have avocado orchards and so on, and macadamia nut orchards all over even North Africa and so on. But those can be destroyed and devastated. And it sounds like what you're saying is that the Europeans, even though they may be able to heat their homes, the question is, where is the food going to come from globally to feed all these populations?
Exactly. Good question. And I really feel that those who promote anthropogenic global warming and denying the existence even grand solar minimal, because their cords cannot reproduce even mountain minimal. So right. The temperature cords run by the IPCC, they cannot reproduce grand solar minimum. They don't have the tools. So they say, oh, it didn't exist. People exaggerated. This is what. But it did exist because there were many mentioned about mountain minimum. And this one, it is upon us. And we cannot do anything. They can say it could be hot. But when you come to the winter, the further we do, we will see snow, and in some years, in 30s, we will see snow possibly in May and June.
Well, and in fact, let me ask you then, what could exacerbate this issue? Because, of course, we are all told by the establishment press and the governments of the world and the IPCC, which, by the way, in my opinion, is engaged in data fabrication. The IPCC tells us that the issue is global warming, and so there have been suggestions to do things like to engage in stratospheric aerosol injection, which is to block solar radiation.
Under no circumstances, because it's a huge pollution and people get diseases breathing this, whatever they put into the atmosphere. Well, it should not be allowed.
Exactly.
No.
But yeah, exactly. But on that point, what I want to ask you is, should they succeed in stratospheric aerosol injection or blocking the sun, or perhaps a super volcano goes off during this time and, ejects additional particulate matter into the atmosphere, further blocking solar radiation from reaching the surface. What are the implications of that if it happens during the grand solar minimum?
It will become even cooler, much cooler. By the way, we publish also papers and on that website that Cycle 26 will have maximum of volcanic eruptions.
Oh, my.
So Not only the sun goes into the hibernation, sleeping mode, but volcanic eruptions become maximal, whatever we haven't seen before. And they contribute to the reduction of the temperature very dramatically. Good that you mentioned it. But this paper also published, and you can find on our website under the publications. And this paper was accepted twice, once to the Nature, and we got accepted, proofread, paid the fee. Suddenly they've seen that I'm predicting grand solar minimum, they decided to withdraw the paper.
Of course.
The similar happened with Astrophysical Journal. Paper was accepted, proofread, and suddenly the editor-in-chief, Vishnya, came to me that, oh, we don't publish in Astrophysical Journal statistical analysis of volcano. And they also decided to withdraw the paper. So, obviously, wow. They're very, very afraid to hear or see the truth.
Well, we have witnessed the same thing, by the way, in medicine. Medical journals recently selectively censoring conclusions that they don't want to see. Yeah. But I want to ask you about the Hunga Tonga volcano eruption, right, which is relatively recent. And apparently that ejected water vapor particles very high, I think, into the stratosphere, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And that had a measurable effect on cooling of certain regions that were covered by that, right?
Absolutely. It's only the small one volcano. And then imagine when it will be serious of volcanic eruption. So it will be much more effective. But you absolutely correct. I agree, Paul.
So is there a link then between volcanic activity and grand solar minimums, or is it is just coincidence that these two things are happening at the same time?
We've done statistical analysis between curve of frequency of volcanic eruptions and variation of this summary curve of our magnetic field eigenvectors, and correlation is 67%.
Wow.
So 67%. So it is not random. It is basically induced by the sun.
What's the theory of the mechanism by which volcanic activity is increased during grand solar minimum?
It is what I understand. I'm not a specialist in volcanic eruptions, but we found that the increase of volcanic eruption is when the eigenvectors, summary curve has southern polarity. And it means that it is a much stronger geomagnetic interaction between solar magnetic field and Earth magnetic field.
I see.
Which caused a lot of geomagnetic disturbances. This is the, it's not magic. It is absolutely physically defined. So
right.
you get magnetic field of particular polarity, which interacts much more effectively with the magnetic field of the Earth. It is inclined, Earth inclined to the sun. And then if it is interacts very effectively, it means that we have more disturbances on the Earth. We have more sunquake, we have more volcanoes, and you name it, we have geomagnetic storms, you name it, everything. So this is will be coming.
So is there a point where you believe the evidence of the grand solar minimum cycles and especially temperatures dropping in years ahead will overwhelm the current narrative of global warming, and at some point authorities will have to acknowledge reality?
Definitely, after 3 years, we start seeing this. Global warming will be remote history. This is why they're saying, quicker, do it, contribute, put all this thing, because they know after 3 years, everyone will see it is not true. To say softly.
What will be the impact, in your view, of the carbon sequestration projects that are being constructed to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere?
It is a disaster. You know, carbon is a very good gas. Every garden center, they put carbon to increase greenery growing in the garden center.
Yes.
So the more carbon, the greener the planet.
That's true.
We, at the moment, our carbon is very low. The planet was much greener in previous million years, so we are not even remotely close that it is dangerous. And moreover, increase of the carbon is the consequence of increase of the temperature and not the reason.
You know, yes.
This guy is completely twisted, you know, reason and consequence. It obviously, they had very poor education. They cannot find the links between reason and consequence. And this is, it is not only my opinion, it is opinion of the man who founded the Greenpeace. It is Patrick Moore. He wrote the book about it. And many others who confirm, and there's even Cosmic Rays, the guys who during the minimal solar activity increase cosmic rays, and they also say that everything is defined by the sun. So we need carbon. We don't need to remove it. We need it more because it is not bad for the planet. It is very good for the planet. We need more greeneries.
Yeah,
we don't
yeah.
have the desert.
Let me add to that. It's very clear. We've covered a lot of this published science where higher concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere not only produce higher crop yields, but they actually increase the nutritive quality of the food that
Absolutely.
Is grown, right? So
yeah.
If you're talking about a grand solar minimum that's going to take us from essentially now through the year 2053 in various degrees and food shortages around the world, the last thing that the world should be doing is taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, which would further
Absolutely.
Reduce crop yields.
It will be reduced anyway because the temperature drops. So it will
Exactly.
be enough harm that it is reduced, but now they won't artificially reduce it. So I think this is a special program to reduce the population of the Earth because I don't see any other reason what they're doing. Putting these idiotic electric cars, which cannot be run in the hot, in the cold, or long distances, which cannot repair because our car insurance company refused to actually insure electric cars because the repair is very expensive, and so on. And this is what they now want to do, remove even this small amount of carbon that we have now in the anticipation on grand solar minimum. This is a disaster. They want to kill more people. This is what my
clearly
personal perception is.
Well, I agree with your conclusion. It's an inescapable conclusion. And I knew this when I saw their war on carbon dioxide. You know, I was in the 10th grade in high school. It was a high school biology class when I first learned about photosynthesis. And it seems like everyone has forgotten that one of the inputs is carbon dioxide and another is sunlight. And the third is water. And if you take away two of the three, you don't get photosynthesis. Or you get, you know, if you reduce two out of the three, even you reduce them a little, you get sharp reductions in botany, you know, plant physiology, which drives the ecosystems of the oceans and the land and the animals and human civilization, correct?
Correct, yeah. So the man with basic logics and understanding, you understand the harm they're doing. So obviously those who are working with IPCC, they lack of this basic logics.
It's incredible.
Because they deliberately deny it to get funding. This is what, if they have big purpose to get funding and become, you know, reach beyond comprehension, it doesn't matter what happened in 30 years because they will be gone and then humankind need to deal without them. So these two versions, either they do not understand and this is beyond their comprehension, or they do understand it very nicely, but deliberately still do it to promote themselves. And because everyone wants to be famous and rewarded by Nobel Prize, like Al Gore for the rubbish.
Right. But famous for genocide, perhaps, is kind of what they're heading towards. But I also get the feeling that, you know, if the public had more knowledge of science and mathematics, they wouldn't be bamboozled, as we say, by claims that carbon dioxide is a pollutant. Because again, like I said, I learned photosynthesis in the 10th grade. I don't think they teach that in the 10th grade anymore.
Exactly. They reduced the program. We have these jokes in the United Kingdom how they teach mathematics from 50 years ago until now. It is simply ridiculous.
Yes.
So it is, and I think they done it deliberately. Reducing the knowledge of people allows them to rule those people much easier. And this is what they can put any rubbish, because people cannot deny. Only few, those who educated well and who still remember, like you and me, mathematics, what they taught, and we were saying, oh no, this is not going to happen. And it is much easier to shut down a few. Either they throw them out from job or start rejecting their papers and so on, than to have pressure from many people. This is why I'm doing popularization through the website and these talks. I'm trying to educate people. I obtain every day possibly about 10, 15 emails, and I try to reply to people, explain. They ask questions. They don't have answers. They have like your natural curiosity and some basic logic, and they understood what they were said is not what they see. And they're asking, what do you say? And I explain them, this is what you see, and this is what the difference between what is said and what is going on in reality.
Yeah, I'm really glad you said that, of what's going on in reality, because, you know, here on Earth, dominated by the psychological warfare, you might say, of the establishments and the so-called authorities, they can fake a lot of things. They can fake data, they can fake, you know, scientific studies, or they can censor legitimate papers, or they can lie to the public. They can count on people being ignorant about photosynthesis, for example. They can do a lot of fakery, a lot of propaganda, but they can't fake the sun. They can't change the sun's activity.
Exactly.
And so eventually reality arrives.
Yeah, this is what we would never be able to prove they're wrong. This is why they're afraid of so grand solar minimal, because whatever I was saying, if we wouldn't come into period of grand solar minimum, I wouldn't have evidence that the sun rules our planet. But when the temperature start dropping and snow coming in May and June, it will be live evidence. It doesn't matter what they say. They may say, we reduce CO2. This is why snow coming in June, because they are twisting the truth. But I'm telling you, before they reduce CO2, it will be snow, it will be cold, because it's ground solar minimum. And only ground solar minimum proves that the sun is the only boiler in the solar system, the only source of heating, nothing else.
All right, very, very important point, that giant fusion generator in the sky, without which all of us would die. What are the implications of the grand solar minimum on ocean ecosystems?
Oh, we just prepared the paper. Hopefully it will be published soon. Actually, the level of the ocean follows the temperature variations. So it will be probably reduction a little bit of temperature, because some water will be frozen, but not much dramatic. So it will be more snow, but still water will be there. So,
but I'm thinking about the solar radiation that's penetrating the surface and you know, providing energy to the ocean life, the plants, and you know, the whole web of life of the ocean ecosystems. What are the implications there?
Well, it will be probably reduced radiation, but I did mention here, on top of this grand solar minimum, which actually activity on the sun is reduced, we have a different effect, which causes a real global warming. So the global warming, increase of the temperature, it is real, but it doesn't come from CO2. It comes because the sun is dragged in from its position in the center of ellipse, in the focus of ellipse of the Earth orbit. It dragged in by the gravity of large planets towards the direction of the spring equinox for the northern hemisphere, to in some way in March. So in March, April, May, June, July, the sun is much closer to the Earth's orbit, and it becomes closer and closer with every year, from 1600 to 2600. This is why we get global warming. And this is why we have heating of the ocean in the southern hemisphere, because when the sun comes closer to the planet, Earth looks into the sun with the southern hemisphere. So all the Pacific, Indian Ocean are heated, and we got this ENSO and others forming there. So this is why we got this global warming. So we have two effects. One is on the sun itself, and another is orbital motion of the planet Earth and the sun itself. So sun is not sitting in the focus of the ellipse, but it migrates. It like fluctuates. It's called flickering. And this astrophysicists know this effect of wobbling star, because how they look for exoplanets? They look at the stars which have this flickering of their luminosity. If they have flickering of luminosity, it indicates that possibly this star has a planetary system which also moves the star from the focus of the orbit to some direction, and this is why luminosity of this star becomes flickering. So it is well known in astrophysics.
I'm very curious about how much impact that has, but let me help translate that to the audience. So the oscillations of the sun out of the focus of the elliptical orbit path of Earth. You're right. That's well known. There are, in fact, you know, two star systems out there where the two stars orbit each other. They wobble each other, and the sun moves towards the Earth as the Earth moves around the sun. But I'm curious about how much impact that could have, because, you know, we're talking about an enormous distance, and, you know, small perturbations in that location wouldn't seem to make that much of a difference.
I publish a book chapter. If you go on my website, it is called Millennial Oscillation of the Solar Radiance.
Okay.
And I show how much distance. The distance between sun and Earth changing from about 0.11 thousandths of astronomical unit. It's a big distance, about 2 to 4 radii of the sun. So it's much closer. Huh. It is not a small amount.
Okay. All right. This, well, I'm fascinated by that. I would love to read that.
We have this global warming. This is why when we published paper in 2019, again in the Nature, when we discovered that magnetic field change of the sun changes with the period of 2,100 years, and we suggested this is because sun and Earth's distance is changing. At that time, I didn't have ephemerides of the sun. The anthropogenic global warming people made campaign against our paper, and within half a year, they made the editors retract the paper.
Oh, really?
On the basis that the distance between sun and Earth doesn't change.
Oh, well, obviously it does change. I'm just wondering how little or large the change is.
At that time, it just started COVID, and we put everyone on the lockdown, and I was sitting at home doing nothing. So what I thought, I download ephemerides of the distance sun and Earth within 2 millennia from 600 to 2600. And this is how my chapter appeared. I've proven that the distance changes. I came back to the editor. I said, excuse me, write me apology and restore the paper. I said, oh, we will not do. You can write new paper and so on. So they're afraid to do it. But they basically lied. But this paper is the most accessible paper. You know how many people access this paper because it's been retracted? It's already 20,000. None of my paper has read it because they did biggest advertising because obviously I found something relevant. And now I've proven this distance changes. And because of this distance changes, now we measured how much the temperature changes, how much the solar radiation changes. We put this solar radiation points, how much it changes onto the temperature, and it follows very nicely the measurements.
I see.
This is the paper is forthcoming.
Well, I'm going to have to obviously take a look at that paper because this is fascinating to me. And I would also point out to the audience that, you know, the distance between the Earth and the Moon is also not a constant.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I think even NASA would admit that. Hopefully.
Astrophysicists, looking at exoplanets, they know this wobbling star, they know star wobbling. Again, we come back that only solar physicists, whatever, Gavin Smith and his team, they don't have basic education. They don't know basic physics, basic astrophysics. You tell me.
It's extraordinary. I am shocked by just the lack of basic logic that we now see across society, not just mathematical illiteracy, but I'm talking about the abandonment of cause and effect, the abandonment of logic, just the unwillingness to engage in reason.
I can understand, but you know, I was born in Ukraine, in the former Soviet Union, but everything was suppressed. We were not allowed to have opinion. We grew up to have our opinion discussed in the kitchens and pick what required in the official sites. And I thought, when I moved to the West, I thought, okay, at least here I can openly say what I'm thinking. And it turned out, to some extent, now I can't. They just restricting the truth. This becomes very, very very unpleasant, I would say.
Well, the West has borrowed... The West has become the thought police of the former Soviet Union. That's for sure, and including in science.
They have a war there, war after war. They have these ideas. Oh my God! I'm Ukrainian, by the way, native.
Yes. So
I'm
struggling
for my country, and hope we win eventually.
But these are all intertwined, isn't it? Because I think humanity cannot find peace and abundance if the world has abandoned reason.
Yes.
And so it's all kind of a bigger picture. And also, you know, think about, although we do have to wrap this up, we're almost out of time, but think about how many people will be suffering from starvation and famine.
Absolutely.
Right. The destruction.
All the grain covered by mines and others, we cannot put crop because you need first remove the mines and put, allow people to come with the equipment there.
Absolutely.
So you cannot do this. People will be suffering from And the similar other countries where they have the war, I'm really, my heart is now with Israel and everything. So is it, and everything bad comes from Russia and Iran, their friends Iran. So what I believe, by the way, the main promoter of the anthropogenic global warming are native Russians who now work in the Western institution.
Really?
So it's strange. Somehow coincided.
Well, that's interesting, because I would add to your list that what we call the neocons in yeah. America, the neocons are pushing the global warming hoax and, of course, all kinds of other programs that harm humanity. Instead of thinking about ways, how can we help human beings become more abundant, more self-reliant, have better nutrition, better food, better health, better peace? I think they sit in their dungeons and they plot the destruction of our world. Frankly, I think that's what they do.
Absolutely. I believe it is my personal opinion. I do not accuse anyone, but I believe it is a special program by Russia and China to destroy Western economy and put these two countries above of any other countries.
Well, so it's working. It is absolutely working. The West is committing economic suicide because of all this nonsense.
Exactly.
Okay, Professor Zarkova, I apologize, we're out of time, but I want to give out your website, solargsm.com.
Yes.
And I really want to thank you for joining us today, because this has been a really fascinating discussion. I very much enjoy speaking with you, because you and I can have an informed talk, which is so rare these days.
Happy to speak with you. And if you have further questions, you can send me an email. I'm happy to explain any further issues.
Okay.
And give me a link later. I will connect it to my website.
Okay.
So listen to our talk.
We will do that. Yeah, we'll get this out in a few days. We'll send you a link. And again, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. And we wish you well.
Okay.
We'll talk again.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Ciao.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And thank all of you for watching today. Of course, Mike Adams here, Brighteon.com. Hope you enjoyed that fascinating interview. Feel free to share it everywhere. And you can just, you know, copy and paste the whole video if you wish. Put it on other channels and other platforms as well. And remember, the link to her website is SolarGSM, which stands for Grand Solar Minimum. So thank you for watching today. God bless you all. Take care.